the second stage, I guess the second there, it will start to burn again to try to get into the final orbit. Now, normally that actually takes quite a long time to get to your final station, keeping in space. There, the fairing drops off so that you have less mass, and now you can get to your orbit. And then finally, you'll drop away that second stage. Now, what's not shown here is there is fuel on that spacecraft for station keeping, because if you just put this one is at will be flying at 825 kilometers, but even there, eventually you'll get some drag from what little atmosphere is up there, and your orbit will decay. So you do need station keeping. So there is a capability in space with fuel to position yourself. And then you see the solar panels unfurl them. And it's really important when that moment happens that you unfurl the solar panel and that you actually start to get power to flow, because as sophisticated as these instruments are, just as sophisticated as your car may be, if you walk outside and find your battery dead in the morning, it does you no good. So if you can't get power on these spacecraft, that's the end of the mission. So let me start showing just show a few examples of the type of imagery you see on the hyperwall. Let me start with the atmosphere. And it's been a very interesting summer along the mid-Atlantic here in the U.S. For those of you that live in this part, you aware of that. And in particular, we had a number of hurricanes providing precipitation in the mid-end of August. And this is an animation from GOES imagery of Hurricane Irene as it moved up the coast. And pretty soon as it gets north of Hispaniola, you'll see the eye begin to form. Miami was very lucky. You see it moving up the coast and quickly becoming extra tropical. But what I'm showing here is the rainfall accumulation from a satellite called TRIM, the Tropical Rainfall Measurement Mission. And what it's showing is accumulated rainfall from this storm. Now, I live in Maryland, not too far from where you see some of those oranges and reds. And yellow is 5 inches of rain. And we had already had plenty of rain before this. And if you get up into red, you're talking about accumulations of up to 10 inches of rain. So we're able to monitor and estimate precipitation from these satellites. And by the way, this uses microwave radiometry primarily to get this data. There's also a radar on TRIM. And here's an example of a slice through Katrina that was done with this radar. Now, this radar, unlike CloudSat I mentioned before, is a lower frequency. It's very similar in character to the weather radars that you're familiar with. And these hot towers are somewhere on the order to maybe 10 to 20 kilometers, and they're representative of very intense convection in the storm, and you cannot see these very well from ground base. And fortunately, the TRIM radar has a resolution of about 5 kilometers and can actually isolate these and see these developments. So with these radars in space, you can actually watch in a hurricane a particular feature that is very closely linked to the intensification of the hurricanes. And it's one of the things that NASA spends a lot of time studying. Ozone. I'm sure you're all familiar with so-called ozone hole. What I'm showing you here is a loop. So we're starting in 1980, and this is from two instruments that NASA's been involved with, TOMS, and then in the later era, one that's on AURA that was a partnership with the Dutch. And purple here means is less ozone, less column ozone. And as you notice, it kind of went fast, but as we moved out of the 80s, you see more blues. And what this is every springtime, it's taking a shot of just the minimum or maximum extent area of the ozone hole. And so you can see in 2010 that there's most of Antarctica appears to have this hole. The maximum or the lowest amount of ozone that was recorded with these satellites was over Antarctica in, I believe, 1996, somewhere around there. But the largest aerial coverage of this hole was, I believe, in 2006. So one of the things that humans, that society's been successful, is phasing out a lot of the chlorine compounds that cause this. And we did a modeling study at NASA Goddard. And in that study, we projected what would have happened if we had not phased out CFCs and other related chlorine compounds. So we're starting in 2011. And it takes till about the middle of this century before we actually start to see a recovery in the ozone hole. We're going pretty fast here, but if you look at the southern hemisphere in particular, you see a lot of blues. That represents less ozone. And as we move into the middle of the century, you're going to see more reds on the right. But if we have done nothing, which is the world we've fortunately avoided, you're going to see more and more blues show up. And as we move through this century, I think you'll find as we move along that we certainly avoided a catastrophe. Obviously, UV radiation at the surface has a lot of consequences on not just animal life, but plants as well. And I'm going to speed this up a little bit. I think we go out to part of the century. But at some point in the mid-century or later, the planet is turning blue there on the right, which represents Dobson units, if you're familiar with that, of less than 100. And that's where we predicted we would have been in 2065 if we had not phased in. So we do modeling studies at NASA, too, and in particular that helps us understand some of the consequences of policy decisions. A couple of images from the ocean. This is a visualization done at the Science Visualization Studio at Goddard, and it's showing you the thermohaline circulation. I misspelled thermohaline there, but you get the idea. The colors there represent ocean density, which is a combination of salinity and temperature. And the deep currents there are not remotely sensed, as you can imagine, but it's our best present understanding of how the deep circulation in the ocean works. And those deep ocean currents, and as we back off from this, you'll start to see a bigger, grander, global picture of this. Those linkages those circulations are on the order of many hundreds of years, if not even greater. And one of the things that drives those deep currents is the density, which is why that's the color image on top of this. And after this image, I'm going to show you some data from Aquarius, which attempts to retrieve surface salinity, which is part of what you need to know to understand density. You'll see the circulation there around Antarctica and such. So I think Hans, who may speak a little bit more about his science interests later, certainly would know more about some of these ocean uses, but that is why we launched Aquarius just this past summer. Now what you're seeing here is first light, if you will, preliminary data from Aquarius. And it used microwave radiometers to try to detect the difference in the emissivity between water that has large salinity contents and less salinity contents. And the color bar there, I realize it's probably hard for you to see, but it goes from 30 in the purples to 40 grams per kilogram. That's the type of sensitivity you're trying to pull out. Let me animate it here. And again, this is preliminary data, but notice that the Atlantic is saltier than the Pacific as we turn around. Particularly the North Atlantic is supposed to be even saltier. You'll see less red colors there in the Pacific, certainly than in the Northern Pacific. And again, this is just preliminary data. At the point that this was taken, Aquarius was not even at its final altitude yet. But again, this is important for understanding ocean circulations, and it looks like we're off to a good start with this And then real quickly, I think you've all heard of the El Niño and La Niña, the ENSO, or the El Niño Southern Oscillation. And this is a composite, just because I think it's very cool, of sea surface temperature and color. So red is warm temperatures, and you're going through an El Niño phase. You're coming out of it now where you have warm waters off the coasts of Peru there. And you can see topography on there, and that's from sea surface heights, where we also have satellites that using active radars to get topography. And then the surface winds are those arrows that are moving so far, so fast you probably couldn't even see it. But in that animation, you transition from one of the strongest El Niños we've seen in the late 90s into a small La Niña phase, where you have the cooler colors there. So finally, let me just conclude with what's the most important to many of us, and that's life and land. I'll just show you a couple of images. And this is treating the Earth as a living synergistic system. This is the breath. This is the breathing of the planet. And what I'm going to show as I start this animation is the Mauna Loa record to the left, starting in 2002. And you'll see the seasonal change in the Mauna Loa CO2 record. But you also see a trend, don't you, even over just this short 4 or 5 year period where CO2 is increasing. We all understand that, and I don't think there's any controversy about that. Now, above that is net primary productivity in both the ocean and the land. And that tries to estimate for you the amount of mass of carbon taken out of the atmosphere per year, per area, by life, whether it be plankton in the ocean or vegetation on the land surface. So as the seasons go, you see the greening of the northern hemisphere and then the dying down. You see, again, you go through the seasons. It's a little hard to talk through. And you see the CO2 following along in a way that represents the uptake and the decaying of carbon on the planet. So that in is very much, you know, the breathing of planet Earth right there. Fires are very important. And that's one of the things that not only can we do with MODIS quite well, but we can also do with NPP. And there's both natural causes such as lightning, as well as burning for agricultural purposes. And in particular, in the animation I'm going to show you, where we'll see southern Africa, primarily all that burning is to provide nutrients back to the crops. It's not clear cutting, although some of it is. Whereas in other parts of the world, Indonesia, the Amazon Basin, where you see fires there, it's usually because you're doing slash and burning. And by the way, I was involved in a field campaign in Africa about 10 years ago, and these pictures were taken during that campaign that I was on. So let's see what MODIS tells us about global fires. And we're going to be going through the years in different ways here. We're going to start off with Australia. And the green colors here represent vegetation. It's NDVI, but it's basically greener means more vegetation density. And then those dots there, the red dots you see, those are fires. Those are detections of fires. And the more red that dot is, although it's hard to see on the screen, the hotter that fire is burning. So let's let this go. I don't know too much about fires personally in Australia, although most of those are natural, as I understand. And, of course, you go through wet and dry seasons in Australia where it becomes a problem. Can you see Indonesia sort of to the south there in Southeast Asia? A lot of fires going on there. A lot of that, especially in Indonesia, is slash and burn practices. When you get into the boreal forests, which I just missed that, you do end up having a lot of natural fires. Now, here's Africa, and if you can kind of follow the months through here, as you move into the dry season, which is July, August, and September, the dry season begins to move south, and you'll see those fires. We're going to cycle through a couple times. Start from the north, and then they're going to move on to the south, and that's just agricultural practices there. Africa, that burning is probably about 70% of all the burning on the planet, maybe more is coming from Africa. And then you saw that it wasn't nearly as extensive despite what you hear in the Amazon Basin. And then, of course, the fires in Mexico and U.S. and North America, these are, for the most part, natural fires. And although in Florida, if you fly here in the summertime, quite often you'll see fires that are set for agricultural purposes. This has been shown on the hyperwall, and this is, I believe, one of my last slides. And that's that ultimately humans do impact the planet, and there's no surprise, and you can see that impact from space. This is Landsat, so now you're looking at 20-30-meter imagery. And you see the population of the county in which Las Vegas resides. It goes from a few hundred thousand in what I guess is the early 70s to up to a couple of million in present day. And you can see the impact of that on land use change there. You also see Lake Mead there, sort of breathing back and forth in this. And as you move into later years, you'll see the effect of the drought on the level of Lake Mead as the Colorado River flow was reduced. Which leads me to a sort of final science slide, and that's population. And so much of the impact of environment, whatever your environmental interest is, if it's present-day land use, if it's an outlook of many generations and climate change, much of that is ultimately linked to population as well as economics. And I believe we're headed very closely, if we're not there, to 7 billion. And I think I was born at a time when there were 3 to 4 billion. I'm not quite sure. And you'll see carbon dioxide record on there, along with other greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide. And you see how those have, in particular CO2, has increased in a proportional way to population. And then if you look at the ice core record, primarily I believe this data probably comes from Antarctica, maybe the Vostok core, which uses oxygen isotopes primarily, you'll see that that record shows that it's fairly stable over the past millennium. And then the black line there represents the current in-situ thermometer record that also increases. So to me, a lot of the sources of environmental issues ultimately are related to both economics, technology, as well as population. And I think this is the kind of plot that brings that home. And then a final slide is, this is the Earth at night. And this shows you where the population centers are. But if you look at this carefully, and you see North America lighting up, the U.S. in particular, this gives you a sense of both population and economics. Because as we turn around, you see China lighting up nicely there. You know, there's most of the people on the planet live in India and China. And if you looked at the density of lighting there, you know, you wouldn't see it as large as it is in parts of the U.S. If you looked at Africa, if you're paying attention there, you'd see very little lights other than maybe around Johannesburg in South Africa. So this, by the way, came from a sensor that flies on the Defense Department satellite Sirius DMSP, which is very sensitive to lights and so can see night lights. And finally, let me close with this. And I borrowed this quote. Not I borrowed it, but I became aware of this quote from NASA's lead scientist, Waleed Abdulati. So I don't take credit for being that learned, okay? But if you look at that quote, man must rise above the earth to the top of the atmosphere beyond, for only thus will he fully understand the world in which he lives. How many of you think that quote came from the last 50 years, say during the space age? Nobody? I would have. Okay, so one. Okay, it's okay to be honest because I was wrong too. Okay, what about the last 100 years, though? Certainly, we had the technology to envision, and I see some heads nodding, and that's what I would have thought. Would you believe that this comes from over 2,000 years ago? And I wanted to give you the answer before you can Google it on your phone. Which, when I've given this talk to students and I use this, this is the first thing you can see them doing is reaching for their phone. So the important thing here is that obviously to give some credit to a person, Socrates, who obviously had a perspective far beyond the people of that day and even today. But I'll let this go while I talk through that. Is we lose sight of the fact that we're in a remarkable age. And humans have dreamed of having the vision of the Earth that we have. And it's become a reality in our time. And even though we take it for granted, like much of our technology, I think it's remarkable what we found out about the planet, not just from space, but of course from all the science studies, scientific studies we've done. And the more we learn about it, I think it's true, the more we learn that there is no place like home. And that tells us a couple things. One is we ought to protect it, and one is we ought to try to learn as much as we can to inform policy decisions and inform the public. And that's why you in particular as journalists are a key part of the NASA effort, which is to make sure that we get the message and the results from science communicated to the public in a meaningful way. And you'll see where this is eventually leading down to. I think you recognize where on the planet we are. So I think the visualizer, this is Landsat Days, so I think the visualizer that put this together was not trying to be have a message. This is the Washington Mall, for those of you that don't see. You can see the Capitol on the right, the Washington Monument to the left. There is no place like home, and eventually choices that lead to how habitable our planet is, lie in policy and the public. And let me just, I'll stop there with one final note, and that's a lot of this imagery you can get yourself. So if you're looking for imagery, or perhaps you're involved in teaching students, a lot of you can get from the Science Visualization Studio, as well as the Earth Observatory. And if Mike Carlos could just raise his hand here, just raise your hand, that's okay. He's the editor of the Earth Observatory, where a lot of this imagery came from. There's news stories as well, so you're not just stuck with an image, there's a description of that. And then behind Mike, Patrick Lynch is with the NASA Public Affairs Office. He's a science writer. And if you have any questions or information that you need about how to access or how to be aware of NASA and what it does, Patrick can help you. I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you very much. We can hold questions for later on, but I really also want to stress the fact that so many people just think that NASA is just about the space shuttle and the astronauts, which I love, but for me, what NASA is doing above that orbit of the space station is far more important in so many respects. Dr. Graber, for those who arrived late, he is the director of the Center for Southeastern Tropics Advanced Remote Sensing, or STARS, C-STARS, here in Miami, and he does a wonderful job with imagery. Thank you.
Thank you, Angela. Good morning, everyone. We're a little bit different from what Steve was telling you what NASA is doing. Unlike that we put satellites in space, we have agreements with a number of different foreign commercial satellite vendors, and we downlink and process these imagery at C-STARS at the University of Miami. And the other part, we differentiate ourselves from what Steve showed you. Rather than giving you this large global view in one image with relatively coarse resolution from our perspective, we give you a much smaller view and at much higher resolution down to 1 meter and less. So you really can zoom in to very fine details and structures. And one additional difference is we work primarily with synthetic aperture radars. Radars, these are active sensors rather than depending on the natural radiation that's reflected from the Earth's surface and then is going towards the satellite sensor in space, we send out a pulse, very much like the police radar when they're trying to get you for speeding. We send this down to the Earth, and then we wait for the echo to come back, and the echo has been altered from the way it was sent, and from this we try to interpret how it interacted with the with the land surface or with vegetation or with water. And from this we then derive environmental information. So we use these imagery in a lot of scientific studies, but we also do a lot of work for the U.S. government where we support them in humanitarian assistance and disaster response. Like recently, the oil tanker of New Zealand that was breaking up, and in the flooding in Thailand as an example. So what you see here is a image from a French satellite, Spot 2, that was taken back in October around this time in 2005. This is Long Point in Lake Erie, Ontario. And we played around a little bit with the colors just to enhance the hydrodynamic features. You see, you have currents basically flowing along this bit of land, and that knife edge at the end starts generating eddies and turbulence. And you see then with the currents, you carry a lot of sediments, and you start seeing the sediment settling out, but quite in a turbulent dynamic way. It's not like things just dropping down. Actually, the currents in the interior of the water still carry these sediment particles. And so you see the fainter ones is very fine sediments that's deeper down, whereas the more denser ones is coarser sediments near the surface. And so this is done with like blue light. Blue light can penetrate the water surface up to about 70 meters. And so with blue light, you can actually look into the interior of the water surface. So that's one way to see what happens in coastal areas. And we have a number of coastal projects dealing with river dynamics to understand how rivers and the ocean interact. So this is a good example of how to use satellite data in research like this. This is a similar picture as Steve showed. This is from the MODIS sensor on Terra, not Aqua. This is the morning bird, I believe. There was a Hurricane Rita entering the Gulf of Mexico. And this gives you an idea with the MODIS sensors. You can capture weather phenomena, as Steve showed in numerous examples, over very large scales. So this is roughly, of the order of up to 1,000 kilometers that you can capture, and certainly category 4 storms like Rita at that time, they span, pretty much 1,000 kilometers. Now, we also work here. I think many of you recognize this is Key West. This comes from a high-resolution satellite sensor called Formosa 2. If you're familiar with geography, there used to be a country called Formosa until it was asked to change its name. This is Taiwan. But they kept the name for the satellite, I guess, as some way of, keeping with their cultural heritage. This is a 2-meter pan-sharpened multispectral image of Key West. So you see the reefs out at the bottom here. You even see some ships, these little white dots, and you see their weights behind. And then on the Gulf of Mexico side, the bay side, you see a lot of structure and details, either the sand dunes underneath, at the bottom of the ocean. This relatively shallow, of the order of, 10 meters to maybe 50 meters, whereas you can see here as you go in on the Atlantic side, you see some coastal features, but then you still see some of the reefs, but then right here, unfortunately I put a little thing here, this becomes dark, that means the ocean is dropping off very rapidly. Now, I mentioned about disaster response. This is an example of a Spot 5. This is also a very high-resolution optical satellite from the French. They have a constellation, or used to have a constellation, of several of these Spot satellites. They're about to launch next in December a very new type of satellite called Pleiades, and then this will be followed by Spot 6 and 7. And they all have capabilities in sub 1 meter resolution. So here you have a false color image. We played around with the infrared channel. That's why the land looks red. So basically, things on land that is not like stone, but trees, or is the lawns, the forests, and so on. They show up in typically in red in infrared with infrared frequencies, and this was a way to highlight the extent of the oil spill from Deepwater Horizon that moved into Barataria Bay in Louisiana. And you also notice in this island here in the middle, you see a little bit of a lighter strip along the beach. This was shortly after they took some bulldozers and scraped off the oil that was settling on the beach. So you can see the difference even between the rest of the land and the freshly scraped off beach. So this is the kind of resolution you can get with the satellite sensors and really focus into smaller details. You also see that clearly the oil is being moved by the surface currents and mimic how the currents were moving around in the bay. That was, of course, used to predict where the oil might go. We, at SeaStars, during that time period, we provided 90% of all the satellite imagery that some of you used. I worked with a lot of you during that time. And all, and you saw in the media, this was done for the US government in particular. And during the 3-month period, we collected over 1,200 imagery on a daily basis, like 15 huge image strips of several hundred kilometers long at resolutions of the order of sub 10 meters to really see what the oil was doing.
How many miles or kilometers across is this?
This is a little bit focused in, but that satellite sensor, the Swarthmore, is about 60 kilometers. So this is another example of, we have the data set from CSAT. This was one of the first, and even to this day, rather unique satellite that NASA put in space back in 1978. It was one of the first missions where there were numerous satellite, numerous sensors on there. It was a synthetic aperture radar. It was a scatterometer, an altimeter, a passive microwave radiometer that Steve talked about, that was put in space, and it was back then, it really revolutionized Earth observations. Unfortunately for CSAT, in 1978, it only lasted about 100 days. But during that time, it imaged and captured some really intriguing imagery. And even if I take this image from more than 30 years ago, and I compare that with the satellite sensors today, this is still, in many cases, 100 times better than what we put in space today. It's amazing, but this is definitely the case. This is a synthetic aperture radar image, about 25 meter resolution of the ice flows near the Beaufort Sea, west of Banks Island. And on the right, I'm showing you a modern-day image from Spot 5 about 30 years later. And you clearly see the difference of, you know, we'll talk about global warming. You see the difference of what's happening to the ice. This is around the same time. We're talking about just a day difference. The ice back then, and in radar, the interpretation, of course, is quite different. First of all, to the left, where you have the solid gray surface, that's all solid ice. What you see then to the right is sort of this frazzled ice broken up, and that was a lot closer to the coast, whereas in 2006, most of the coastline was already ice-free. So there's clearly a lot of credence with respect to the global warming, that the ice coverage in the northern as well as in the southern polar regions is basically melting away. To get back again to the oil spill, this is a radar image of the oil spill, and clearly everyone can see the oil. That's nice about radars. First of all, they are all weather sensors, and they can operate an image day and night. So they don't have to wait until daylight comes out, or they don't have to wait until the clouds go away, and obviously if you're in Miami or in the Gulf of Mexico, clouds is probably a prevalence of something like 60 to 70% throughout the year. So optical sensors don't really help you a lot. If you study clouds that Steve is interested in, that's a different story. But if you really want to see what's on the surface, you're much better off with radar. Radars penetrate clouds. They also penetrate snow, and they penetrate rain. It depends. There are, of course, some frequency differences. But the frequencies we use are sort of in the single-digit gigahertz range. And the wavelengths of these electromagnetic waves are from about a centimeter to maybe 30 to 40 centimeters. And they respond, of course, quite differently. So you can see clearly the black area. This is the oil from Deepwater Horizon. This was done with Inbisat SAR, which is a satellite sensor from the European Space Agency. And this is what we did on a daily basis for the Coast Guard. We marked the coastline in a very simple red and blue line, because what I wanted to know on a daily basis is, where is the oil? So we marked it with red when the oil was within about 10 kilometers of about 10 miles of the beach or the shore, or some ecological wetlands, and we marked it blue if the oil was 10 miles further away. And they use these maps to allocate their resources meaning the vessels, many of the voluntary vessels, as well as the vessels from the Coast Guard and the states and so on, to prevent the oil from either reaching the beach or getting into some of the wetlands around the Mississippi Delta. This is a very high resolution satellite sensor called Eros B from an Israeli company, and this shows this is about 70 centimeters, so this is 2 feet. And what you can see here is, you see the jet skis off Miami Beach and some small pleasure boats, but you also see two small airplanes pulling banners behind them. And of course, you also see a lot of structure on the ocean surface. You can count here the individual waves. So this gives you an idea of what you can do with satellites nowadays, you know, the kind of resolution. That this is all on the in the commercial domain. Obviously, I can't tell you what is done on the government side. But if they can do this, you can probably, you know, sort of extrapolate and see what else might be possible. So anyway, this is my last slide, and if any of you have some interest, you're welcome to visit us. We certainly do a lot more than what I, you know, shown here. We've just finished a big experiment in the Western Pacific on improving weather forecasting of typhoons, where we use a lot of these radar satellites to look at the wind and sea states, wind fields and sea states of typhoons, because with the recent loss of, as Steve was saying, a lot of the NASA satellites are aging, and there's not a fast enough replenishing of some of the sensors. And about a year ago, the scatterometer QuickSCAT stopped operating. And this is down now to a European sensor only. And so synthetic aperture radars, and there are several of them up there now, about almost 10 of them, they can do similar things as the scatterometers, but provide very high resolution imagery of and wind field characteristics of the typhoons and the hurricanes. We do some of the monitoring here together with the Canadian Space Agency and the European Space Agency of the hurricanes in the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico, and that's used by the US government in particular for damage assessment, like in the case with Irene recently that went into North Carolina and then New York State and into the New England states. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Andres, would you come on over and think about, you have to plug it.
Oh, I do want to say, if you have some interest, I'll do this right now. I brought some calendars. I know it's the end of the year, but this gives you some idea of our, you see a lot of other of these examples.
So our next speaker. This is great because we go from the really above the planet with NASA. We are going on a close-up with Dr. Graver, and now we're going on a more extreme close-up with Andres Alfonso, who is from Colombia. Disregard your printed program because we had a last-minute change, the Peruvian person who didn't make it. And then I found this little, very interesting company from Colombia. Andres Alfonso opened Sequoia Space. And it is fantastic because it is the perfect example of how Latin America is getting into the space age for environmental purposes. He develops and builds nanosatellites, and he has one to show us and to tell us how he did it in 10 minutes, and then we'll have some questions for all of the panelists for about another 10 minutes. So take it away. Perhaps say you.
You're a teenager.
You should know. In any case, while we wait, I do know that I don't know if you mentioned this, Dr. Platnik, when I was gone briefly, but there is a new Earth observing satellite that is going to be launched like literally within the next 2 or 3 days, isn't it?
Next Friday.
It's a polar orbiting satellite again, right? And perhaps later on you can tell us a bit about it. Actually, let's do it now while they get ready. You can tell us a bit about the satellite.
Well, I hope some of you, if you're either in the print or video media, might be able to actually talk about MPP. That's the satellite's being launched next Friday out of Vandenberg, and that's what I was showing the animation of earlier. As I said in my talk, the five instruments on MPP are meant to bridge and continue some of the data records from EOS as well as serve for operational purposes for those. So we can talk about that later in the answer period.
Right.
Andres, you're ready.
Okay, so first of all, I have to say two things. My presentation will be very brief, and the second thing is sorry for my English. The most important of this presentation, the most important thing of this presentation is maybe that you will be able to wrap a small satellite in your hands. My name is Andres Alfonso. I'm a co-founder of Sequoia Technologies, that is that is Sequoia Space, and I'm the tech and production manager. So in the first steps of the humankind, we could see the development of this deep satellites like Sputnik. Sputnik was launched for the Russian space program, and the mission was very, very simple. The, that satellite sent temperature data, and it lasted a few days in the space or working. So in the space programs, many countries have been developing huge satellites to do many things, like I saw in the previous presentations, like the Earth observation. So in the last decade, we have a lot of applications using small satellites. So these two men are the creators of the small satellites standard called CubeSat. The CubeSat is a standard that have developed a lot of countries, developing countries, and the man in the left is Robert Twiggs. Robert Twiggs created in Stanford a lot of things of CubeSat standard, and Jordi Puxuari, the right in the picture, worked in Cal Poly University creating a lot of things like Cal Poly Deployer is called the PPOT, Poly Pico Satellite Orbital Deployer, that contains satellite in the rocket, and then when the rocket reach the orbit, the deployer delivers the satellites in the space. So I'm going. This one of the satellites that I'm talking to you. So
regeneration.
So these satellites are be able to do a lot of things. For example, the satellites can have cameras and sensors and many electronic components to do a lot of things. If you want. So this kind of developments have been very important in the space development in universities and developing countries like Colombia, like Peru, like countries in Africa. So right now there are almost 50 or 60 programs building on their own satellites, and there are so many communities that is developing CubeSats. For example, here in the United States, there is a community called CubeSat Community that is hosted in Cal Poly University in California, and every year in April they meet in the university to talk about their developments and the new projects about small satellites. In Colombia, was made a CubeSat that was launched in April 2007. But if you look at the picture, you can realize that the satellite has no solar cells, because regulation in the United States called ITAR. ITAR is International Traffic in Arms Regulation that doesn't allow to access some technology. That in this case we couldn't to get the solar cells on that time in 2006. But right now in Europe, you can get something about aerospace technology like solar cells, like the satellite that is in the room. So as a result of the interest in space technology and space development in Colombia, it was created the Colombian Space Commission in 2006, and right now it's creating Colombian Agency for Aerospace Affairs, and a lot of projects will be created in the couple years. So, as a part of that interest, we decided to create Sequoia Space in 2007. That is a small company with 8 people working on satellites development, like you're watching. So we started representing a company called Pumpkin Incorporated, or CubeSat Kit, that is the main product. So our main interest is to spread out this knowledge on Latin America, and to make the people create their own applications using small satellites, like in the previous presentations, like Earth observation with small sensors and different technology that is available in the market. And right now, for example, we don't have radio mirrors in satellites, but I think in the future, or in a couple decades, we will see small satellites doing the task of the huge satellites observing the Earth. So we create, or we design and develop systems like ADC, attitude determination and control systems, common and data handlings, radios in VHF or UHF and S-bands. We develop solar panels. We develop battery packs to support missions in Latin America, even United States, like 2 missions are interested in some of products of Sequoia Space. Okay, this picture was taken in 2007 for a small satellite called AeroCube-2. AeroCube-2 was developed in Aerospace Corporation, and this moment was the PPOT, or the Polypico Satellite Orbital Deployer, deliver the satellites in the orbit. And the AeroCube took the picture to a CP3 that was a satellite of Cal Poly University. So here's a video of our antenna deployment system. In the CubeSat standard, it says that the satellite has to deliver their antennas, or its antennas, 30 minutes after to be deployed of the deployment system. So I said that it would be very brief.
This has been fantastic, fantastic. Congratulations. I think this is like the democratization of space, don't you think, Steve? And I really wanted him to show you this because probably Latin America and the rest of the developing world is going to now have their own capabilities and couple them with NASA. Questions, you guys. We have about 5 or 6 minutes for questions, and then the speakers are going to be available throughout the rest of the morning if they can. So just come to the microphone and... No, because we are recording, Enrique. Thank you. Very good, thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Henrique from Brazil. I would like to address André a question. What kind of data can these satellites collect from space is the first question. And the second one, is there any interest in bringing the idea to Brazil and maybe starting some partnership with the Brazilian Space Agency?
What kind of data? There is a lot of mission involved in the small satellites like CubeSats, like captured data in the orbits, in the low orbits, in the lower orbits. So you can capture images that don't in that resolution that is the previous presentation, but in this moment there are a lot of projects developing cameras in 3U's or satellites in 30 centimeters by 10 by 10 centimeters. So this kind of satellites and this standard is in developing. It is still in developing. So, but there are a lot of applications to get data from the space.
What about the second question? Is there any interest in maybe partnering with the Brazilian Space Agency or something? We would very much like to do more.
Would you like to?
We'll talk about it later, I guess. Okay. let's have a second question from the
Good morning, and thanks to all of you for your presentations. I also have a question for, about the nanosatellite. I'm Barbara Fraser, and I live in Peru. I write from Peru. I'm a freelancer. What countries are using these nanosatellites? How much does it cost for someone to, for a country to get one, to deploy it? And what kind of the countries that are using them, what kind of infrastructure do they have to have? To what level does a country's space program have to have developed in order really to use one of these?
Okay. The standard CubeSat is very useful because every country can get to develop satellites. So right now, there are a lot of countries. Even Sudan in Africa brought us to Sequoia Space to acquire some parts to start their own mission. So One mission could be 200,000 dollars starting. So the launch could be $40,000, and it's very cheap compared with huge satellites and millions of dollars.
Any other questions? Yeah. We're reaching the end of the questions, but I'm sure you can approach Dr. Braver and Dr. Platnik afterwards.
I'm Ellie Summer, a graduate student at the University of Florida, and my question is there an agency or an association that is monitoring all the things in space, and how can we as a world keep space cleaner than we're keeping our Earth?
What's the take? Probably.
As Hans said, I'm the one who probably should be able to.
I'm sorry.
The question is essentially about space debris, and it is becoming a serious issue. One of the things that NASA has an office at Kennedy Space Center that is a part of at least a U.S. effort to monitor that space debris. In fact, objects larger than a particular size, and I'm not entirely sure I can recall what that is, it may be, say, 10 centimeters or so, maybe more. But routinely we can monitor those. And I believe that we do have some information on our website. We could probably get you later. It actually shows some animation and some information about that debris. But periodically, we on our NASA assets have to do orbital maneuvers to get away from debris that's coming close to our satellites. So it becomes an issue. What I cannot answer, and I'm not entirely sure, is whether there's an international community that is actually trying to address this. In particular, for it to be effective, it has to include all the international partners, including China, which, as many of you know, had a demonstration of how to create debris by launching a missile at a satellite they have in space, which has created some extra debris that we have to be aware of. So I'm not sure if Hans can add to whatever international